I was there. Talks by men who saw the making of history. Nowadays, a passenger to America has no misgivings. But nearly a generation ago, a terrible catastrophe in mid-ocean had to mark the end of an era of peril in Atlantic transport. On the 15th of April, 1912, the Titanic struck an iceberg, and in a couple of hours, a great liner had sunk on her maiden voyage at a cost in human life of 1,500 souls. Commander Lightoller was second officer, and when he had seen the last of the insufficient lifeboats pull away from the ship, he plunged into the sea and was ultimately rescued. All the other officers who went down with the ship were drowned. Commander Lightoller.
Altogether, I have had four shipwrecks and a fire during my 30-odd years at sea. But by far and away the worst of them all was the one I'm going to tell you about now, the loss of the Titanic. I joined her in Belfast while she was still in the builder's hands, the biggest and finest ship in the world. And given the normal life of a ship, I'm pretty sure she would have proved the fastest. But let me say right here and now, neither that night nor that voyage were we out for any records. We ran our trials in Belfast Lough and then took her round to Southampton. On April the 10th, that's 1912, she sailed on her maiden and only voyage for New York. From the moment we left Belfast, we had marvelous weather. And even when we got out on the Western Ocean, or Atlantic, as you probably know it, it was as smooth as the proverbial mill pond. Not a breath of wind, and the sea like a sheet of glass. In any other circumstances, those conditions would have been ideal. But anyone with experience of ice at sea knows that those very conditions, and the moonless night, only render the detection of icebergs all the more difficult and calls for additional alertness on the part of both officers and men. Speaking for myself, I knew only too well that there were chances, if long ones, of sighting an iceberg. But as I reckoned, in ample time to clear it with a turn of the wheel. On that night of April the 14th, we all, that is, the captain and officers, knew perfectly well that we were just about entering the region where ice might be sighted at that particular time of the year, and had taken all necessary precautions. Now, throughout the day, there had been the usual wireless messages from different ships reporting the weather, odd icebergs, and so forth. But as none of these bergs reported lay on our course, well, they didn't directly concern us. But when the evidence came to be sifted out at the inquiry held in London afterwards, it then came out that one very vital message received in the Titanic's wireless room that night had never been delivered to the bridge. That message came from a ship called the Mesaba, warning all ships of heavy pack ice, icebergs, and field ice in an area then lying right ahead of the Titanic, and what was still worse, not far away. Those immense quantities of ice were abnormal for almost any time of the year, and the significance we should have attached to that report can hardly be exaggerated. In my opinion, it was a warning of the most vital importance. You see, I was officer of the watch and in charge of the ship when that Mesaba message came over. And I know perfectly well what I should have done if it had come to my hand. Without a shadow of doubt, I should have slowed her down at once. That would have been imperative, and sent for the captain. More than likely, in fact, almost certainly, he would have stopped the ship altogether and waited for daylight to feel his way through. Anyhow, the long and short of it is, neither he, nor I, nor any other officer of the ship got that message. Now to go on. We were steaming that night at a good 22 knots. At 10 o'clock, I was relieved as officer of the watch by Murdoch, W.M. Murdoch. He and I had been shipmates in many of the ocean greyhounds. And both of us had crossed this ice region times without number. both in clear weather and what's more in fog. After the usual formalities, I handed over, wished him joy of a few perishing cold hours, and went below. I expect his watch went on as mine had done. Nothing to see, nothing to hear, except the distant roar of the water at her bows, that and the half-hourly bells with a lookoutman's cry of all's well. Of course, he knew nothing of the death trap lying ahead of us, any more than I did. And so, five bells, six bells, and seven bells went by. But barely 10 minutes had passed after the sound of the last bell when there were three sharp clangs on the crow's nest bell, followed by a cry from the lookout cage, "Ice right ahead, sir!" Murdoch evidently saw the mass of ice practically at the same time as the lookout men and shouted, "Hard a starboard, full speed astern!" His idea was to swing her bow clear and then put the helm hard over the other way and so swing her stern clear. And given half a chance, I believe he'd have done it. But going at that speed, it was too late. As it was, her bow swung a bit, but not enough, and she struck. She took the blow along her starboard side, masses of ice actually falling on the foredeck. But what was worse, though we didn't know that till it came out of the inquiry, she was pierced below the waterline in no less than 6 compartments, and from that moment, nothing could have saved her. I was lying in my bunk when I felt the slight jar, not any sense of collision, but more a kind of shiver that ran through the ship. Anyway, it was enough to bring me out of my bunk in one jump. Out on deck, I ran over one side and then to the other, but there wasn't a trace of anything we'd struck. So back I went to my bunk and just waited. If I was wanted, naturally my cabin would be the first place where anyone sent for me would look. You see, apart from being nearly frozen, even an officer, when off watch, isn't exactly welcomed on the bridge, either in pajamas or anything else. Anyway, it wasn't long before Boxall, the fourth officer, poked his head round my door and said, "Do you know we've struck an iceberg?" "I know you've struck something," I told him, not thinking it anything serious and feeling none too pleased. Then he said, "The water's up to F-deck in the mailroom." There was no need for him to say anything more. I was into a pair of pants, sweater, and bridge coat and out on deck almost as soon as he was. Now we've been running under a big head of steam, and the sudden stopping of the engines lifted every safety valve. And as a result, the steam roared off at all exhausts. The row was absolutely deafening. Added to that, the engineer started to blow the boilers down. "Shout as loud as you like." No one could hear a word. At the same time that Boxall had called me, the order had been given, all hands on deck. And I met my watch tumbling up on the boat deck just as I got there. And the boat deck, just in case you don't know, is the top deck of all. I got hold of the boatswain's mate and sort of showed him with my hand that I wanted him to start the men stripping off the boat covers. Now, in the merchant service, men are taught to think and, if necessary, act for themselves. They don't wait for pipes or bugles, and I can tell you, the 700-odd survivors of that night can thank God they don't. Every man Jack just went about his job well as if it were an everyday occurrence. When the boats were stripped and cleared, they were swung out and lowered to the level of the boat deck. Just a little while before they were ready to swing out, I happened to meet the captain, and I asked him, by cupping my hands over his ear and yelling at the top of my voice, "Shall I get the women and children away, sir?" He just nodded, so I started to fill the first boat. Just about now, thank goodness, the roar of escaping steam stopped, and passengers, now they could hear themselves think, started asking me, Why are you getting the boats out? And why are you putting women and children in them? I told them it was merely a precaution and that very likely they'd all be taken on board again at daylight, or at the worst, taken on board the ship everyone could clearly see only a few miles away. We could see all her lights quite plainly. But here again we were up against it. That ship was the Californian, and though her lights were plain to everyone on board the Titanic, she seemed to pay not the slightest heed either to our wireless calls or to the distress signals we were firing every minute. The reason why she didn't answer our wireless calls, which other ships heard halfway around the earth, was because she only carried one wireless operator. And when we struck the iceberg, he'd just gone off watch, so it was no fault of his. But why no notice was taken of our distress signals, shells that are fired hundreds of feet up into the air to explode with a cascade of stars, heaven only knows. What a chance her captain missed. He could have laid his ship right alongside the Titanic and taken practically every soul on board. However, he didn't, and the two ships gradually drifted further and further apart. And, according to the officer of the watch, Californian, the Titanic's lights disappeared at 2:40 a.m. They did. And with his own eyes, he'd personally witnessed one of the greatest tragedies of the sea. But to go back again, up to the time of getting away the first few boats, no one believed that the ship was actually in any danger. I'm afraid my own confidence that she wouldn't or couldn't sink rather conveyed itself to others. For there were actually cases where women absolutely refused to be put in a boat. I remember one young couple, evidently not long married, walking up and down the boat deck. I asked the girl, she was only a girl, from the western states, I should say, if I should put her in a boat. But no, she wouldn't be parted from her husband. Not on your life, she said. We've started together, and we'll finish together. Brave girl, but she didn't know how near that finish was. Certainly I didn't. As time went on, I could see the bows of the ship getting steadily lower and lower in the water. Now, between lowering one boat and another, I frequently took a run forward and a quick look down a long stairway that led from the boat deck three or four decks down. Frankly, I'm never likely to forget the sight of that cold, greenish water creeping step by step up that stairway. Some of the lights were shining down on the water, and others, already submerged, were giving it a sort of ghastly transparency. But for my purpose, I could tell by that staircase measurement exactly what was happening, how far down she'd gone, and how quickly she was going. Just when I first realized how desperately serious things were, I don't know. But I do know that before many boats were away, I got to piling more and more people into them. Partly because I now knew she was going, and partly because the boats were not remaining by the ship to be filled to their full capacity when waterborne. A far easier job than lowering them with their full complement from that tremendous height. Another thing, it was plain to me that if we were going to avoid the unutterable disgrace of going down with boats still hanging at the davits, we'd got not only to take chances, but we'd got to work like blazing. I've always admired the coolness and efficiency of merchant service sailors in a tight corner, and I've seen a few. But that night, well, the Titanic's men set up a standard that'll never be beaten. Every single boat was filled and lowered from David Head to water and got away without an accident of any kind. And that despite the pitch-black night and the conditions we were working under. The same tribute must be paid to the passengers for the courage they showed. For by the time little more than half the boats had gone, I knew, and I'm pretty certain they knew, that she was definitely going down. You've got to remember, the Californian had drifted away. There weren't enough boats to take half the people, and the chances of the other half in that icy cold water were absolutely nil. Yet, there was never the slightest attempt to get into a boat out of turn. In fact, with the last couple of boats, it was even difficult to find women to fill them, though of course there were still a good many on board. Then came the very last boat of all, and it was a sort of raft with collapsible canvas sides, stowed upside down on top of the officers' quarters, and that's above the boat deck. A seaman named Hemming, he'd been with me in many of the mail boats, he and I cut this one adrift and threw it down on the water, which was now about 2 feet above the boat deck. Hemming, by the way, had earlier on given up his place in a boat after being told off to take charge of it, and unbeknown to me, had followed round, helping me with the lowering. A ticklish job even in daylight. Having dumped this collapsible, there was not a thing further we could do on that side, so both of us went over to the starboard side. But we found all the boats were away from there, too. Of course, there were still hundreds of people round. As Hemming and I looked down from the top of the officers' quarters where we were standing, the ship took a sudden dip, and a sea came rolling up, carrying everyone with it. Many were drowned there and then. Everyone that could just instinctively started to scramble up towards the after end of the ship. But that was only putting it off. In fact, it was lessening their chances. The plunge had to come, and that, I could see, was pretty soon. And no one's chances are going to be improved by getting mixed up in a struggling mass. Hemming, as I found out afterwards, headed for one of the after boat falls, slid down, dropped into the water, swam away, and was eventually saved. For my part, I turned forward and took a header from the top of the wheelhouse. I started to swim away, but got sucked down two or three times. In fact, I got mighty near the edge of things before I finally came up alongside the collapsible. We'd hove into the water from the top of the officers' quarters, and there I hung on. A bit later, the forward funnel guys carried away, and the funnel, weighing perhaps 50 or 60 tons, fell down with a crash on the water. It missed the raft by, and some of us hanging on to it, by inches. But there were a good many it didn't miss. Next thing I remember, I was still hanging on to a bit of rope attached to the raft, but some 30 or 40 yards away from the ship. The wash of the falling funnel had evidently picked us up, raft and all, and flung us clear of the ship altogether. Several of us scrambled up onto the slippery bottom of the raft, and it was from there I saw the Titanic sink. As I watched, I could see her bow getting deeper and deeper in the water, with the foremast sticking up above the surface, whilst her stern lifted higher and higher, till it was right out of the water. When she got to an angle of about 60 degrees, there was a sullen sort of rumbling roar, as her massive boilers all left their beds and went crashing down through the bulk's heads and everything that stood in their way. Up to that moment, she had stood out as clear with her rows of electric lights all burning. When the boilers broke away, she was, of course, plunged into absolute darkness. Though her huge black outline was still perfectly distinct, up against the stars and sky. Slowly, she reared up on end, till at last She was absolutely perpendicular. Then, quite quietly, but quicker and quicker, she seemed just to slide away under the surface and disappear. As she vanished, everyone round me on the upturned boat, as though they could hardly believe it, just said, "She's gone." Some little time later, I found that the senior wireless operator was standing just behind me. And from the wireless messages he told me he'd received from different ships, I figured up in my mind that the Cunard liner, Carpathia, one that he said was coming to our rescue, should be up about daylight. It was then I first heard of the Mesaba message, and when I said I didn't remember it, he told me he'd put it under a paperweight at his elbow and never sent it to the bridge. Many died from cold during the night, the wireless operator amongst them. And a mighty long time it seemed before daylight broke, standing wet through and up to our knees in icy water on that upturned boat. Frankly, I don't think many of us expected to see daylight. At one time during the night, someone suggested we should say "Our Father." And I don't think it was exactly scare that made everyone join in. But you'd need to be in somewhat the same fix, where a couple of minutes may mean all the difference between, well, here and hereafter, to understand the feeling we put into it. I've heard that prayer ever since I was the height of 6 pennyworth of cockers, but never with such intense earnestness as the surroundings lent to it that night. However, when daylight did break, most of us were still heads up, and we of the upturned boat transferred to one of the lifeboats. At full daylight, there was the Carpathia steaming toward us. I didn't say just what sort of a welcome sight it was, either. Cruising slowly round, she collected the boats one by one. Mine, I know, was loaded down to the gunwales, and no easy job to keep afloat in the rising sea. At last, everyone was safely on board, and with the 700-odd survivors of that night, she turned away from that tragic spot and headed for New York.
I went on watch at 8 o'clock on that Sunday night, the 14th of April, along with Moody, who was the 6th officer, and we went on the bridge with Mr. Murdoch, the first officer. It was a clear night. There was no signs of any fog. A set of stars was handed over to me that Lightoller had taken in the second dog watch. When I got these stars, I said, "Now, Moody, you go around the decks and come back at 9 o'clock. I don't know whether the captain came up before 9 o'clock or after 9 o'clock, but anyway, I didn't leave the bridge until after 10 o'clock, having worked the stars out, and when the captain came up, I showed him the position on the chart. She was just over 20 miles ahead of the dead reckoning. And at 10 o'clock, I told Moody to take over the bridge, and I reported to the first officer that I was going round the decks. It was the customary thing. At the time when the iceberg was reported from the crow's nest, when they struck the bells, I was sitting in my cabin having a cup of tea, and immediately got up and walked along to the bridge, about 60 feet away on the same deck. I was about halfway between the officers' quarters, the entrance to the officers' quarters and the bridge, when the crash came. And it didn't break my step. She was doing full speed, and it didn't break my step. And I got to the bridge, and the captain had evidently arrived about the same moment. And I heard him say to Murdoch, what's the matter? What have you stuck? He said, "We've stuck an iceberg, sir." He said, "I'm going full speed astern, sir, on the port engine." He swung her head round towards port, and she was on the swing, and that's why she was torn underneath. She was penetrated in 6 compartments. Well, whilst the captain was talking to Murdoch at the starboard wing of the bridge, I slipped down to go forward and have a look to see if I could find any damage. Nobody told me to go. You had to go down about 4 bridge ladders, you see. And I went forward to the entrance to the third class. These third class passengers, you Southern European people, were streaming up on deck, and I went down below. I think it was 2 decks down, as low as I could go without removing any hatches or anything. I went down to the third class, crossed over to the starboard side, and I walked along there and looked in the cross passages. I couldn't hear any noise. I couldn't see any damage. And I eventually came up on deck again. As I was emerging on the deck, some of these men were on their way back again to their beds. And there was one man had a piece of ice, and I took it away out of his hands, wondering where he got it from. And I spoke to him in English and tried to make him understand that it was nothing, there was nothing the matter. Go down and go to bed and go to sleep again, you see. And I took this piece of ice and walked along the upper deck on the starboard side to see where the ice came from. And there, just inside of the ship's rail, there was a powdering of ice running along as though she'd compressed it. There was no wind, you see, and it would fall inboard. I came up onto the bridge again and reported to the captain, "I've been down below, sir, right down as far as I could go without removing hatches or tarpaulins or anything, right through the third class accommodation forward, and I don't see any signs of any damage, not even a glass port broken." He said, "Did you see the carpenter anywhere, Mr. Boxall?" I said, "No, sir, I didn't." He said, "I do wish you would go down and find him and tell him to sound the ship round for and let me know right away." Well, I didn't get down all the ladders down to the fore deck. I met the carpenter coming up, absolutely out of breath, and he said, "Mr. Boxall," he said, "the forepeak hatch is blown off, and number one tarpaulin is ballooning up." He said, "She's evidently making water fast." So I said, "All right, go along, carpenter. The captain is on the starboard wing of the bridge, and tell the captain." I didn't get down to the fore deck because I met a mail clerk coming up. And he said, "Mr. Boxall, the mail room's filling." So I said, "Oh, carry on, and you'll find the captain on the starboard wing of the bridge and report to him." I said, "I'll go down there and have a look." So I continued on my way down to the mail room. I tried to go into the first class entrance from that lower deck, from the foredeck, but they'd got the watertight door closed. I had to come up all these ladders and go up over the promenade deck and then down through the main saloon entrance, where I found the band was beginning to tune up. And I got my way down to the mail room, and I got down as far as the sorting room, and all the mail clerks were there pulling letters out of the racks. And I was standing on the top of a companionway from the sorting room down to the handing room. And I saw a bag floating by. I instinctively stooped down to try and pick it up. I just couldn't reach it. I realized then that it was serious. So I started to come back again. When I got to the first class passenger accommodation, I met one of the assistant stewards. And he said, "Mr. Boxall, shall I send some men down there?" I said, "I think you'd better not. I'll go up and report this to the bridge, and we'll send down and let you know." As I came up through the top lounge where the band was, they were playing Alexandra's Ragtime Band. And I got back to the boat deck and saw the captain, and I told him, I said, "The mail room's filling, sir. Should I send a distress signal?" And the captain said, "I've already sent a distress signal. What position did you send it from?" He said, "From the 8 o'clock DR. Well, I said, "That was about, she was about 20 miles ahead of that, sir. If you like, I will run the position up from the star position up to the time of the contact with the iceberg. And because I said she was about 20 miles ahead of her position, amended this position and took it on to the wireless room. And Phillips, the wireless operator, was bending over his instrument, the telephone, holding the telephone. He says, I'm in contact with the Carpathia. Well, I put the amended position down on the desk, and I said, now, send that amended position. Do you understand? He said, yes. Well, I said, send that off right away. And that was the position that the Carpathia came to. And I worked on the boat covers, taking off the boat covers on the boat deck, when I heard the crow's nest report a light on the starboard bow. Well, I went on the bridge right away. I found this light with my own glasses, but I wanted the telescope to define what it was, and I realized then that it was two mast headlights of a steamer below the horizon. And the lights were very close, and I went back and told the captain, there's a steamer in sight, very nearly ahead, but slightly on the starboard bow. And if she continues on her course, she'll pass close to us down the port side. Oh, I asked the captain, shall I send up some distress rockets? Then we started sending off these distress rockets, the quartermaster and I on the bridge. But I never knew how many I had fired. I knew very well that there was some in the box. A box holds a dozen, and when I told the captain, I said, there are still some in there, sir, but I don't know how many I fired. I didn't see any reply. Some of the passengers that was on the bridge said that they did see a reply. We also called up the ship as she drew closer with a Morse lamp, a very powerful Morse lamp that we had. And eventually, this steamer approached and approached until you could see all our lights with a naked eye. And I should say that she must have been within 5 miles off. You could not only see her lights with a naked eye, but you could see the lights in her portholes. So I reckon that she must have been within 5 miles. And then eventually she turned away and showed a stern light. And about that time, the captain came across the bridge and said, Mr. Boxall, you go away in that boat, pointing to the port emergency boat number 2. And he said, now hurry up, Mr. Wilde is waiting to lower it. So I said, you see that white light over there? So pointing it out to him, he said, yes. I said, that is the stern light of that ship. I tumbled into this boat. They'd started to lower her. I tumbled into this lifeboat and we got lowered down. I found that I only had 3 of the ship's crew, a steward, a cook, and a sailor. She had been lowered very slowly. She wouldn't run until you helped the falls, and eventually became waterborne. I tried to count the passengers, but it was difficult as they didn't speak English, you see. And I reckon that I had between 30, around about 30 on board the boat. And the captain looked over the side from the bridge and sung out and said, told me to go round to the starboard side, to the gangway doors, which was practically opposite side to where I was lowered. I had great difficulty in getting the boat round there. There was suction. I was using the stroke oar, standing up, and there was a lady helping. She was steering the boat round the ship's stern. When I passed round the boat to try and get to this gangway door on the starboard side, her propellers were out of water. I'm not certain if I didn't pass underneath them. But when I did eventually reach there, I found that there was such a mob standing in the gangway doors, really, I don't go alongside, because if they'd jumped, they would have swamped the boat. She was only a small boat. Would hold about 35 people. No buoyancy tanks in her at all. Boat that was always turned out, ready for emergency purposes like man overboard. However, I decided that it was not, that I don't go alongside again. And I pulled off and laid off until I pulled away about a quarter of a mile, I suppose. And I couldn't, what struck me as being strange, that all the other boats, I couldn't see one of them. Long before I left the bridge, a telephone message had come through from the first officer who was aft. He'd been lowering all the starboard boats, and he'd told the quartermaster aft to report to the bridge that all the starboard boats had gone. That's a long time before I left the ship. Well, those boats must have pulled round to the port side, which was really the south side. And I was on the starboard side, on the north side of the ship, all alone. I couldn't see a boat anywhere. That is when I burnt the green light to try and attract the other boats, but I never found them. The sea was perfectly smooth when we left the ship. Every star in the heavens was visible, but there was no moon. So it was dark. And, everything was very peaceful. No wind. And, no moon, stars, smooth water, until after about an hour the wind got up and there was a little sea. For a long time we didn't move the boat when we laid off on the starboard side. You could see by the arrangements of the lights, all the lights were burning, and you could see that she was going down. You could see that her stern was getting pretty low in the water. She was certainly going down. There was no doubt about it then. And, we got away clear of the ship, and we just laid on the oars until eventually they realized that she'd gone, and we heard all the screams. We couldn't do anything. And, the screams went on for some considerable time. I can't remember the time when she sank, but it was in the early hours. I didn't see any ice whilst I was in the boat, but I could hear there was a little breeze sprang up before we got to the Carpathia, and I could hear the water on the ice, field ice or whatever it was. But I never saw any ice until after we'd been picked up by the Carpathia. Eventually, we saw a rocket go up. And it turned out to be the Carpathia. So she'd seen my green light that I'd burnt. So I burnt another one. And eventually, she steered for the position that I was in. And consequently, I was the first boat picked up. People on the Carpathia told me that it was about just before 4 o'clock, about 4:05, I think. I got alongside there. Everything was ready. Derricks was hoisted. Derrick falls had bowlines in them, and there was ladders over the side. Absolutely everything had been done that was possible to be done. And the captain kept sending down to know if there was an officer in the boat and send him up at once. But I sent a message back, when I get the boat empty, then I'll come up. I've only got one sailor in the boat. And eventually the boat emptied, and then I went up to the captain's, Captain Rostron on the bridge. And he said, where's the ship? I said, she's sunk. And I said, I don't know where the other boats are. I've not seen any of them. But they'd be all to the southward of us somewhere. And it was daylight eventually before any boats were sighted. And it was nearly 8 o'clock, I think. As near as I can remember, it was certainly broad daylight when we picked up the other boats. We cruised around in the Carpathia then. And eventually picked up all the other boats. And some of them were hoisted and left in their davits, and some were turned in and put on the deck. We steamed over the ground in the daylight. The Californian. She appeared. I don't remember seeing any other ships. The captain was going to put his officers on watch and watch. So we Titanic officers, the juniors, that was Moody and Pittman and I, we went on watches. We took soundings because we got fog all the way into New York.
What was the first real indication you had that something had gone wrong?
Well, I went to the gala dinner. I had on a white satin evening dress. And after the gala dinner, knowing that we were going to post letters, I thought it a good idea to go up to the drawing room and write a few letters. And as I sat there writing, this was on Sunday night, the rule and regulations of White Star are lights out 11:30, especially on Sunday. So I was writing, and the call was lights out. And I turned to the steward and I handed him my letters and I said, I'll pay you for the lamps tomorrow morning, but take the letters, they're ready. And I walked down quietly down the hallway until I got to my stateroom. And just before going to my stateroom, A11, there was a bump. As I turned the handle of my room, there was another bump. And as I got into my room, there was a third bump. I thought to myself, what are these bumps? Sort of little pushes, nothing very violent. And I had made a date with the gentleman to take a cup of coffee with him that night. And I called out to him at a nearby stateroom and I said, come on, see what the bumps are. And I slipped on a coat over my white satin evening dress and went right out from my own stateroom, because my stateroom had a door leading to the promenade deck. And as I got out on the promenade deck, I saw a large gray, well, it looked to me like a building floating by. Great big gray thing. But that building kept bumping along the rail, and as it bumped, it sliced off bits of ice, and ice fell all over the deck. And I, and a great many of my foolish fellow passengers, we just picked up the ice and started to play snowballs. We thought it was fun. We asked the officers if there was any danger, and said, no, nothing at all, nothing at all. Nothing at all, just a mere nothing. We just hit an iceberg. It's nothing, nothing. I remember looking over the rail and seeing a fully lighted ship very close by. I've always said that I saw a man walking on the deck, and I did. They claim I didn't, but I'm extremely farsighted. As a matter of fact, I had defective eyesight, and I was too farsighted. Now that ship, we were told, was a California. And it was the California. With all the denials that have been made since, it was the California.
How are you so sure of that?
What's that?
How are you so sure of that?
Because it was the only other ship, and when we got on the Carpathia, we were told by Captain Rostron that the Carpathia was standing by, and the officers on the Titanic told us all, don't worry, the California will pick up everybody in case you don't come back for breakfast. Now, we were told we were only going to leave because it was rules and regulations. No danger whatsoever. We'd all be back for breakfast. And I thought it was perfectly asinine to leave a warm, comfortable ship to come back for breakfast. Well, that was why. The English have got rules and regulations, but they're just plumb crazy. I'm sticking to this ship.
And you had no idea, even long after you hit the iceberg, that you were in real danger?
No, I just thought it was ridiculous, ridiculous. So I went to bed. I was in bed, and some man, I never yet identified who he was, came to my door, knocked at the door, and said, "Madam, get up. They're claiming that women and children should leave the ship. Put on your life belt. Get up." So I got out of bed. I only had one woolen dress that was out. A sheath dress, a half a yard around the ankles, so tight that from my hips to my ankles, I was practically, well, I would say I was in a potato sack. I couldn't walk. I had a hobble. In those days, they were called hobble skirts. And there I was in this tight skirt, absolutely useless. And I put on a wool cap and a couple of foxes. I remember a white fox and a brown fox or something. And the thinnest fur coat I had, a broad tail, which I might as well have put a tissue paper on. I couldn't have been dressed more ridiculously, and lovely velvet slippers with diamond buckles. Now, I had promised my mother never to leave my little mascot. I thought nothing of danger, and the little mascot was left on my dressing table. But I did do something that was clearly idiotic. I locked the windows of all of my staterooms. I locked every trunk. I locked the bureau drawers and the cupboards. I took all the keys, the trunk keys, and then went forward on the same deck to the drawing room, A deck, and sat down comfortably in a big easy chair. And as I sat there, Wareham, my steward, came along, and I said, "Wareham, here's my trunk keys and my stateroom keys. I want my keys. I understand we're being taken off the ship, and maybe you're going to be towed to Newfoundland, and maybe I won't come back in time. So here's my trunk keys. When you get to Newfoundland, go to the customs and send my trunks down to New York, will you?" He said, "You go on in, kiss your trunks goodbye." I said, "You think there's danger?" "Well," he said, "I've got 5 children at home. I'm a bit worried. I believe I'd kiss my trunks goodbye." "Oh," I said, "for goodness sakes, go back and get my pig. It's on the dressing table." And I handed him the key to my stateroom, and he came back with the pig. And my fellow passengers looked at me in utter disgust. I noticed a great many passengers forming a queue, taking their jewelry and their money from the safe. Well, I thought everything would be safer in the safe, so I left all my jewelry and I left all my money in the safe. And this little pig was never a money bag. It's been associated over the years on television shows and films that I had enough cupidity to save my money bank. I never saved a penny, not a nickel. And it took me 3.5 years of acute starvation to pay back my debts. So I had my little pig, and I felt safe. Now, why did I have the little pig? How did I come to have it?
You tell me.
Well, in 1911, I was going to the races in Deauville, again, to cover the races. And I drove to Deauville, down that dreadful, what they call the Hill of Death, before you get to Deauville. The young man who was driving the car took the wheel, didn't permit his chauffeur to drive the car. He'd never driven a car in his life before. And he went headlong into a tree. Everybody was killed but me. And were it not for the fact that in those days they had tires strapped to the back of the car, and I, by a streak of fate, was tossed into the tire. I was a little bit of a skinny thing. I wouldn't be here to tell you the story. My life was saved. I never remembered that motor accident, although they questioned me. But the night in the lifeboat, every detail, the most gruesome and the most horrible of that accident, came to me vividly. Every detail of the horror of that accident I remembered in detail in the lifeboat.
But carrying that pig, which became your mascot, how did you get from the Titanic into the lifeboat?
Well, I made up my mind I wasn't going to leave the ship. Bruce Ismay stood on B deck and kept calling out, "All women and children, come to B deck." I went up twice. It was so cold. I thought myself, "It's idiotic. I'm going back." And I went back twice to A deck and sat down until finally Bruce Ismay spied me and called out to me. He said, "All women and children," I thought had left the ship, "come up here." And I walked up to B deck, and Bruce Ismay picked me up, well, it was almost as if I was a rat terrier, and threw me down a little winding iron staircase. I fell down the iron staircase and found myself between a line of sailors on either side. And I looked down and found I'd lost one of my buckles on my shoe. I wanted that buckle. I was that much interested in the buckle and absolutely disinterested in anything pertaining to saving my life, because after all, it was an unsinkable ship, you see. What could happen to me? Moreover, I had my little pig. Nothing could happen to me. So I walked along the rail, and I found a gentleman standing at the rail. Strangely enough, the very gentleman that I had told on the tender that I was frightened to take the Titanic. And he said to me, "Hello, come on. You're going to get off of this ship." And I said, "Not me. How do you expect me to get off of anything with this thing I've got on? I'm a prisoner in my own skirt. I can't even walk, much less get up to that rail and then jump across the ocean into a lifeboat. Oh, no, not me. I'm not an acrobat." Well, he says, "You'll have to." And as I stood there arguing with him, and I had my little pig, mind you, under my arm, it was white, you know, under my arm, a sailor came along. He said, "Yeah, now you can do as you want, but I'm going to save your baby." And he grabbed the pig, threw it into the lifeboat. So I turned around to Mr. Monk and I said, "That settles it. Here I go. I don't know how I'm going to go, but I've got to go. I'm going to follow that pig. I promised my mother." Well, he may have thought I was insane. Nobody knew what the pig meant to me. So he made a cradle of his hands with another gentleman. I sat on his hands, put my arms around his neck, and he threw me head foremost through space. And I fell on the bottom of the boat and kept looking and looking for my pig. I found him with his broken, poor little legs broken, and his nose gone. Well, made me feel very badly, but I kind of turned him. I found he was still playing music, so that was all right.
Can you remember how many of you there were in the lifeboat?
Yes. I've managed to find a place on the gunwale and found that I was the next to last passenger in the last lifeboat and the only lifeboat that was full. 68 passengers, about one-third of them nearly children. That was the only lifeboat that carried the children.
And how long before you were picked up?
Well, as we left the ship, the fall lines were knotted. They cut them with a knife. We struck the water. I think it was 10 minutes to 2 or 5 minutes to 2. The ship stood there fully lighted, absolutely lighted, music playing. We heard that in the lifeboat. We still saw the lighted ship alongside. In our lifeboat, we had 3 sets of oars, perfectly useless. The ocean was just as flat, well, as a bathtub. I never saw a lake quite that flat. Inky black night, starlit, and not a ripple in the sea. And the kind of cold, well, if you want to know what kind of cold it is, just open your refrigerator door, take a seat inside and shut the door, and you'll know what it felt like. The kind of cold that your skin seemed to congeal. Now, there I was, with nothing on practically, silk stockings, no underwear, no nothing, just about freezing to death. I sat on the gunwale, and the children were crying and whimpering. It suddenly struck me, I believe I'll play music, and then the little children maybe will be diverted and amused. And there I sat, and all night long I played the machiche. And the poor little children were so interested in the music box that most of them stopped crying. Excepting one little fellow. He squealed like a pig. And strangely enough, years later, only a few years ago, there was a reunion of Titanic survivors in New York, very few of us. And a great big strapping 6-footer came up to me. I believe he said he was a grandfather. Said to me, I was one of the babies in your lifeboat. And I said, well, I don't recognize you. You look so different today. He said, yes, I'm grown up now. But my mother's here. And then I remembered that that little baby had been thrown by his mother in the wastebasket, and she just walked off the ship, took a lifeboat, forgot all about the baby, and only remembered when she got on the Carpathia that she ever did have a baby. And were it not for the stewardess that heard a whimpering in the wastebasket in one of the cabins, that 6-footer would not have been there to talk to me. So that's the only time I've ever been reunited with one of the babies.
And how long was it before the Carpathia picked you up?
Well, we left the ship at 2:10. It was 8:05, they told me. We got alongside of the Carpathia the next morning. And at that time, Bruce Ismay pulled up alongside in a lace-frilled shirt, black trousers with stripes, braids down, no overcoat, not dressed, and not in a lifeboat, as people claim, standing up in the last collapsible raft. He came alongside a few minutes after we, the last lifeboat, pulled alongside of the Carpathia. I boarded the Carpathia around about 8 o'clock. They put us on little wooden planks with a rope around us. I think they call it boatswain's cradles or something of that kind. I'm not very up on nautical terms. I ought to be, but I'm not.
Have you ever traveled by boat since?
I only travel by ship. I never will travel by aeroplane. And I've traveled time and again since. And Franklin of the White Star made me return 6 months later in the same cabin with the same setup so that I would not be frightened and I would never be conscious on an ocean steamer. But after the Titanic, on the same White Star line, I was on the Majestic when she broke in half, and I was on the Olympic when she struck a tidal wave. As a matter of fact, a great many of the captains sort of avoided me, and I often wonder if the Titanic could have escaped me. I really believe sometimes I sunk the Titanic.
The first boats that got away were only half filled. And then the boats that were swinging up in the davits on the starboard side were packed, and people were trying, they were trying to get in all the way, and they were being pushed, pulled back and knocked back, and there was a bit of chaos there.
Were women and children getting on the boat first?
We got all the women and children we possibly could away first. And some of the women wouldn't leave their husbands, and we couldn't get them away. But the boats were really, truly filled up. But nobody realized then that she would sink, you know.
She was supposed to be unsinkable.
Absolutely. She had a double bottom, but unfortunately, when we hit that berg, it tore her from forehead right off the engine room, and the water simply went straight up into her. Bulkheads couldn't save a ship, because she had it. She was torn right out. It's like a knife cutting right through her.
Then you got the port lifeboats away. What happened to the starboard ones eventually?
The starboard boats were swinging in the davits, packed up, and until she gradually went down by the head and righted herself, then we were able to get those boats away. But not all of them, unfortunately. They hurried the first two, and they were tipped. They hit the boat, and all the occupants were tipped into the water.
Then what happened to yourself? You were still on board.
I was still on board, and I couldn't do much more then. It was, we only had a... She struck at 12, and she was away at... She was down by 1:30. And I couldn't do any more then, so I began to think of myself a little bit. And then I was... I had hid a life jacket, and I thought I'd go and find it. Well, we couldn't do any more, so the place was packed then. Oh, everybody was on deck milling around. Some were crying, some were praying. I felt rather sad myself, and so I went right aft, right up on the poop. And when I got up there, before I got up there, she was going down by the head very fast then. And I could hear everything was movable, was crashing through the ship. And in the well where the water was, you could see the water, and the stern was right out. And there were people there struggling and crying and doing all sorts of things, and some jumping overboard. And eventually, I was hanging on to the rail, and one or two up there with me had already slipped down into the water, that is, in the well of the ship, you see.
Oh, yes.
So I thought then, I felt her go down, and then she came up again. Is this like a cork, like a float, you see, sort of going down and bobbing up, and thought it was time to leave her, and so I dropped overboard then.
How far down was that?
Oh, God, I don't know. It seemed an awful long way, but I think it's over 100 feet. And I had a life jacket on, of course. that didn't that knocked all the wind out of me, but I eventually recovered, and we were with a crowd of people then. They were all milling about in the water, saying keep together, and we'd have more chance of being picked up by lifeboats. But anyway, I had an idea where the lifeboats were after we sent up rockets from the bridge, and I sort of, on my unconscious mind, sort of sent me towards them, and I was eventually picked up after about 4 hours.
The evening came, and it's time to have your supper, and after supper we had community singing, and it was very, very nice, but awfully cold. So I said, I excused myself, and I said, well, I'm going to bed, it's too cold, it's about 10:30. And I was in bed in a little while, and no sooner I fell asleep, and I was sound asleep when I was awakened by the ceasing of the vibration of the boat. And I thought, well, something has happened. So I got out of bed, and finally I got into the lounge where some men were smoking, and they said, what's the matter with you, to me? Well, I said, what's the matter with me? I want to know what's the matter with the boat. And he said, oh, this isn't anything. We just grazed an iceberg.
As time went by, though, it became apparent the Titanic was in serious trouble. Soon lifeboats were being loaded.
You could not get people to go on lifeboats. You could not. They felt safer on the Titanic than in the lifeboats. But as we were running away, we could see the Titanic gradually sinking. All lights are lit, and this row of lights would disappear, the next row of lights disappeared. And I tell you, I could see, well, just goodbye for everybody. Finally, when the boat did touch water, that scream of death is worse than any siren. And our master, the man who was manning our boat, is the master of arms, Bailey. He got us all to scream as loudly as we could. And then when she finally made her dip, he got us all to sing, pull for the shore, sailors, pull for the shore.
What was it like coming back on the Carpathia?
Very, very bad. It took us 4 days to get to New York. And I tell you, it was an awful trip.
It must have been a happy arrival, though, in New York.
Oh, how could it be happy, you know, the sad drive out there? You don't get happy when you know 1,500 were drowned. How could you be happy? No, you're sad.
Unlike other survivors, the traumatic effects have not stayed with Mrs. McKenzie. The memories, though, haven't completely vanished.
I've had vivid dreams of the Titanic, and every time I see this ship, she's way up in the sky, which I don't understand. I see the Titanic full blast, always up in the sky, but I never dreamed of her going down or anything. I've never had any nasty dreams of her.
Perhaps the most remarkable thing about Mrs. McKenzie is how clearly she recalls an event that occurred more than 60 years ago. About the voyage, she says, some things she remembers as if they took place yesterday. One of those is that song she sung aboard the lifeboat.
Pull for the shore, sailor, pull for the shore. Heed not the rolling waves of bend to the oar. Safe in lifeboat, sailors, la 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 la. Leave the poor old stranded ship and pull for the shore.
How came you were on board the Titanic in 1912? What happened?
I was with my parents. My father was going to open a business in Winnipeg, and the intention was to go to New York and stay for a fortnight or so with a relative of his and then go on by train. People were saying to my mother and father, how fortunate you are to have got on the Titanic, because we weren't booked in her. We weren't supposed to go in her. We were supposed to sail in a ship called the Philadelphia, but owing to a coal strike, the Philadelphia didn't sail, and that's how we were transferred to the Titanic.
Were you at that time tremendously excited?
I was indeed. Not because it was a maiden voyage, that conveyed nothing to a child, but excited because my father was so delighted about it and my mother was horrified.
Horrified? Now, why was that?
My mother said to my father, isn't that the ship that they say is unsinkable? And he said, no, this is the ship that is unsinkable. And so clearly I remember the look on her face when she said, but that is flying in the face of God. And I am so frightened. My mother never went to bed in that ship at all.
That's extraordinary. Of course, what happens is now when I see pictures of the Titanic, it fills me with a kind of horror. But I'm wondering whether I'm projecting on it what I know about the vessel, these four sinister funnels and so on like that. Is that a feeling you had at the time before the terrible disaster, or just a young girl's excitement?
No. I was excited because I was going in a wonderful big ship with my mother and father. I had no feeling of fear or of apprehension or of anything. But my mother was terrified, so terrified that she said, I will not go to bed in this ship. And she went to bed all day and sat up all night. So I can thank her for being here today.
So you went to Southampton and you went on board the ship. What do you remember of the Titanic? What was she like to be actually on board her, inside her?
Well, very beautiful. It was the first time I'd ever been in a ship. And so at that time, I don't suppose I was as impressed as I would be now, because with hindsight, and having travelled in quite a number of ships since, I realised how very beautiful it was. I was a second-class passenger, which again was, from what I remember, quite as beautiful as some of the smaller first-class ships I've travelled in. But in the first class, it must have been absolutely out of this world. I'm told, on very good authority, there were Turkish baths, there were gymnasiums, there was a fantastic staircase, which I imagine the ladies would sweep down in their Edwardian dresses. And it must have been luxurious beyond words.
Now, what was the boat deck like? That was the great area on the top, wasn't it, where people would walk along. Can you describe what it was like to walk along as far as you could? Because, of course, you couldn't walk, I believe, all the way along as you were second class.
Well, it was a lovely big deck with these lifeboats at the side and these enormous funnels and lots of deck chairs and plenty of people walking about. And the weather was so cold. I was quite glad when my father, who had charge of me all day, because I say my mother was asleep, I was quite glad when we went inside to the nurseries and places to play. But it was a very lovely deck, of course, very large.
Let's get on then to the voyage. She moved away from Southampton, she went to Cherbourg, then to Ireland, and then set out across the Atlantic itself. What was life like on board?
Well, there were three classes. I can't say anything about the first or the third. But for the second class, I don't think that the fact of being at sea conveys very much to a child. There was so much to do. I was so fond of my father. And I'm quite sure I got away with a lot of things with him that I never would have done for my mother. He spoiled me very much. And the days went by and I was very happy.
Did you by any chance, even though you were in second class, meet the captain?
Oh, yes, I did. Captain Smith, he was on deck. And when my father and I were on deck, I imagine he went all over the ship. And he was very nice. He had a beard like my own grandfather, and he admired a doll I had. I had this beautifully dressed doll, and I had a big teddy bear too, which a lot of the children used to play with. And he admired my doll. I remember talking to him and my father telling me that he was the captain.
In those days, they wouldn't have had a cinema. You said they had a nursery?
Yes, a room where we played with dolls and rocking horses and things, yes. I don't know whether they called it a nursery, but it reminded me of my own.
What about the dining room? Because the second-class dining room, looking at the plans now, we can see was huge. It stretched the whole width of the ship.
It seemed to me to be very large, and looking at the plan, of course, it obviously was very large. I remember my father commenting on the food and saying how good it was, and there seems to be a copy of a second-class menu for luncheon, I think, on the Sunday, as she said, on the Sunday night. I've seen that in so many books. But I can't say I remember eating it, obviously.
Well, came the fatal day itself, which you said indeed was a Sunday. Have you any memories of that Sunday before she actually struck the iceberg, or was it just a pleasant Sunday? Or did you have services on board ship or anything like that?
Most certainly I have very vivid memories of that Sunday, because my mother, who normally got me ready for breakfast and came and had breakfast and then went to bed for the rest of the day, my mother decided after breakfast that she wouldn't go to bed. She'd wait up for the church service, which was held in the second-class dining saloon. And she did, and we went to this church service. I thought that immediately after she would go to bed, but she decided to have lunch with us. So that was the last meal that the three of us ever had together, because, of course, by the time one had dinner at night, I was in bed. But we had lunch together, and I don't know. I can't say whether I felt any particular anything, except that it was the first time that she'd stayed up for lunch. And that I remember very clearly. And I got very friendly with a little dog, which I believe belonged to a very wealthy American, but it was being taken to America. The owner wasn't on board. And I got very friendly with this little dog and used to play with it. I used to have to go aft I suppose, onto the third-class deck alone. And my father got friendly with one of the sailors who used to take me. And I remember playing with that little dog. And, of course, after the sinking, I was worried about that little dog. It wasn't safe, of course. But I remember that Sunday very well.
Well, came the actual moment when she struck the iceberg, the Titanic struck the iceberg, which happened at 20 to 12 on Sunday night. Now, you were presumably in bed. Were you asleep? Were you awake?
Oh, no, I was sound asleep. And my mother, of course, wasn't, and she said to my father, you must go up on deck and see what's happened. And she'd had him up on deck the night before because she heard a noise, so he wasn't very happy about going up. But she absolutely pulled him out of bed. She wakened me and she said, I'm going to dress you. But before she could do so, my father came back from going up onto the deck and he said, you'd better put this thick coat of mine on. That was all he said. And, you know, years afterwards, I would say to my mother, when he came back, you didn't say to him, what was it? Surely the normal thing to do would have been, if you sent someone to look for something, when they came back, to say, what is it? But she said, I didn't have to ask him. I didn't know what it was. I only knew that it was this awful fear that had been with me. Anyway, she put this thick coat on and he picked me up and wrapped a blanket round me. And we went up onto the boat deck.
So up into the boat deck, and already quite a lot was happening. Within about 20 to 25 minutes, they were uncovering the boats. What can you remember what you saw and heard up there at that time?
I always query that they were doing that so quickly. It seemed a very long time to me because my father said to my mother, stay here by this lifeboat and I will go and find someone and see if we can find out what's happened. Because we were on the port side of the ship and you know, don't you, that the impact was on the starboard side. And the superstructure of that ship was a huge funnel. It was very high. Standing on the deck, you couldn't see what had happened the other side unless you went either aft or forward and went round. And he came back quite quickly and said, the ship has struck an iceberg. My mother didn't say, I told you so, or anything like that. She just remained quite quietly. And then he went away again and came back and said, I've been speaking to one of the officers and they are going to lower the boats, but you'll all be back on board for breakfast. And all that took place, which always makes me feel that that 25 minutes isn't quite right, but I could be wrong. Anyway, they did, of course. Though the boats, and my father had no difficulty in putting my mother and I in because, as I say, we were there. But he made no attempt at all to get in himself.
Was there a tremendous bustle? I mean, one's read so much now, it's part of the folk memory about the band playing, about the appalling sound of the steam being let off from the funnels. I mean, can you remember that? What do you remember about going on round you?
I remember the steam. It terrified me for years. I remember the steam hissing. I remember some music playing. And I refute the fact that it was an orchestra. I'm quite sure in Bill McQuist's film, A Night's Remember, when he featured three musicians, that was much more likely to be right. And Commander Boxall said so too. So it's not a band, and I think you'd have to be very close to hear it, and we were. I remember the fact that there didn't seem to be such a lot of people about when we got into the lifeboat. But then it seemed throngs of people were coming onto the deck. And when we were down in the water, we could hear the people rushing about on the deck. And I'm sure that's when the panic must have started, when people got up onto the deck and found there wasn't a lifeboat there.
As a 7-year-old child, were you frightened at that moment, or were you just curious?
I was terrified.
And you really knew that something appalling was happening, no doubt at that age at all?
I would have been an idiot not to. Of course I knew. I wasn't certain what a shipwreck meant in effect or how long it would be, but I was too terrified to do anything but shriek for my father, who I knew we'd left behind, and to be terrified of the whole thing.
It was an extraordinary business, wasn't it? Because here we have a shipwreck taking place on an absolutely flat, calm night. Can you describe the scene? Here you are now in the lifeboat, and you're looking back. What did the Titanic actually look like before she actually sank?
Well, before she sank, she was a very beautiful ship, stationary on the ocean with all her lights on. I don't know what the temperature was, except that it was dreadfully cold, but the sea was the calmest I think I've ever seen. It was the most starlit night I've ever seen. The sea was so calm, it was uncannily calm. And then gradually she sort of, it seemed to me, to sort of settle down in the water. You are so low on the ocean in a lifeboat that it's not very easy to gauge heights and distances. Four parts of the ship dived down nose first, but I don't know how long it was, but it seemed a terribly long time. But even when that part went under the water, the lights were still on, you know. And I looked back and I just saw the whole of that tragedy. I saw that ship break in half, and all through these years when people have said it didn't, I still maintain that I was wide awake and never closed my eyes again. And my mother also, a thoroughly sensible woman, used to say, of course it broke in half, and the front part went down and left the stern sticking up in the air in a horrifying fashion, and that gradually went down, turning over. I know that's a fact. But it was enormous. And even when we were so far away that she sank, and you get as far away as you can because of the suction, it was a tremendous ship. But I am absolutely convinced, of course, that she broke in half. There's no doubt about that. And the stern stuck up in the air for a long time, it seemed to me.
Well, indeed. In the latest evidence, which we've seen from the expedition, underwater expedition, we know that the stern is a considerable distance away from the bow. So, in other words, it could not have broken up just underwater. And the second thing is, according to Walter Lord's latest book called The Night Lives On, he quotes, I think, something like 16 witnesses who bear that out as well.
That's right. My mother was perfectly firm about it. And as I say, she was a very calm, sensible sort of woman. And she was absolutely convinced about it, and so was I. Oh, I saw it. Yes. And over these years, people have talked to me and said, oh, no, you're quite wrong, you were too young to remember. I was not too young to remember. I was not too young to see a dreadful thing like that and never forget it, and I know it happened.
Many reports say that as she broke up or she went underwater, there was also a tremendous sound, a roaring sound.
That's right, there was. Tremendous roaring sound. And there'd been all this escaping steam, I suppose, as they drew the boilers, I don't know, but the noise of steam was absolutely terrible. And she did have a big roaring sound. And after that came the worst sound of the whole disaster, which was the sound of people drowning. And that's something that no one can hear and ever forget. I used to say to my mother sometimes how dreadful that was, and she used to say to me, yes, but do you remember the dreadful silence that followed it? And it was. It seemed as if the whole world was standing still for minutes after the last sounds went.
Yes, I should think it was. There you were, with the vessel gone. Can you remember what happened, apart from these terrible cries, what else was happening around you? Were you surrounded by other boats? Was it,
They keep all the lifeboats as close together as they can. And it was discovered that the boat that I was in was overcrowded. And the officer in charge of our boat, Fifth Officer Lowe, decided that he would get rid of his load by putting two in that one and three in that one and four in that one, calling them all together, and go off with an empty boat when he picked up a few people who died quite quickly. So that boat could have been properly filled in the beginning if it had a boat drill. Now, during the course of two going into this boat and three going into that, I got separated from my mother. I didn't find her until the next day on board the Carpathia.
In fact, we now know that the Titanic ran not merely into an iceberg, but in fact there was a whole ice field.
Yes, the next morning, as you looked round, they were like white sails. In the distance, you could see them like white yachts. I don't mean white. Yes, white sails on yachts. With the sun on them, were very beautiful. But they were all round us, yes.
So you have this extraordinary contrast, the horror, and a few hours later, something which really was very, very beautiful.
Yes, it was. The sea began to get a bit choppy as it got light. But the icebergs, whatever direction you looked in, they were there. They reminded me as a child of the sails of a yacht.
There have been reports, again, there's so many confusing details, that there was a light somewhere on the horizon. In other words, a ship close by which might have come and rescued, but of course didn't until it was too late.
That's absolutely true, because I can remember constantly saying to my mother in that first lifeboat, why doesn't that other ship come? You could see it clearly.
You were rescued, a few hours later?
You see, I don't know what time I left the Titanic. People say to me, when did you get in the boat? I can't tell you. I got in the boat when it was lowered. I know that I was transferred into another lifeboat from the original one, as I've told you. And that one that I was in then was the last one to be taken up in the Carpathia, and I understand that was about 8 o'clock in the morning.
You were rescued by the Carpathia. What happened then?
Well, they were very kind and good to us. I was shrieking my head off for my mother and eventually found her, because she had no idea where I was. She had been put into a boat, I suppose, probably, say, off the starboard side of the lifeboat, and a sailor grabbed me on the port side of the lifeboat and pushed me in another one. I don't know. I only know that when I got into the second lifeboat, she wasn't there. And as she said, when she was put in the other lifeboat, I wasn't there. But I found her, I don't know how long after. We were given clothes, because I'd only got my night clothes and a blanket around me. My mother, of course, was fully dressed, because she sat up all night fully dressed every night of the voyage. But they were very kind and good to us, but of course they hadn't got cabins for us, because I suppose the little ship was pretty full anyway, and she was quite small. But I can remember I was put on a settee in a dining room and looked after as well as I could.
What happened to you then? You eventually arrived where? New York?
New York, yes.
You realise eventually, obviously, that your father had gone. I mean, do we now have years of misery ahead of you after that? Or?
No. The first thing my mother said when we got to New York was, how soon can I go home again? There was no point in her going on to Canada. My father was a master builder, going into partnership there with a friend. Well, that was, she couldn't manage that business. So we came straight back to England and back to my mother's parents, who were still alive. And although for the rest of my life I didn't have as much money as I would have had when my father was alive, because we were pretty comfortably off. But he had gone to Canada, or was going to Canada, because his business wasn't very good. But anyway, we managed, and my mother and I were very happy. We were terribly upset about my father, but life went on from there.
And from there, of course, well, I'm not going to ask you to summarise the whole of 75 years, but we had, but we had what? We had the First World War, the Russian Revolution, the Second World War, Hitler's come and gone, we've had China going communist. I mean, we had all that. I mean,
and I lived in one of the heaviest bombed parts of London. The bombs fell here right through the war to a terrible extent. I felt, well, if there's one with my name on, I should get it.
So you had that to put up with as well.
Oh, yes.
Quite alive. Of course, what has happened recently is that the Titanic has suddenly surfaced again. And it surfaced again because, of course, of the Woods Hole expedition. Dr. Robert Ballard found her in 1985. And I wonder what your reaction was initially, when presumably, like all of us, you saw on television, first of all, a picture of a boiler undersea, and then these tremendous pictures which came up.
It's very difficult to say. They didn't convey to me anything about the Titanic at all. I was glued to the pictures because I thought they were such a wonderful scientific achievement. They were a wonderful thing, but it never at any time gave me the horrors like pictures of the Titanic do. I've got enormous admiration for Dr. Ballard, because I did so hope that no one would ever attempt to raise parts of the Titanic. I won't say raise the Titanic, because it's in bits. But I was so grateful about his attitude, and he has written to me, and I hope to meet him next month. And I felt it was wonderful, but it didn't upset me from the point of view of it being the Titanic.
This is what I noticed different. I said, we've got one interview of you a few years ago in the BBC, a very short one, and at that time, you couldn't, for example, describe the sinking. It so upset you, you said, it sank, and that was it.
Yes.
Whereas now, you have given me a wonderful description, and you seem now at least to have been able to come to terms all these years later, at least be able to describe this event without being appalled. Well, you're obviously intellectually appalled, but mercifully, you haven't been emotionally overcome by it now.
Well, I've done so many television programmes in the last 10 years in, oh, everywhere, Germany, France, Canada, America, Australia, Singapore. I've done so many for so long now, and as we've got so scarce on the ground, there's nobody around, I think that's helped me.
Yes. It almost, dare I say, it might have been almost a form of inadvertent therapy.
Yes,
I mean,
possibly. That's why I first went to sea. My mother died when I was 23, and from the time of the Titanic disaster until she died, I was so frightened I wouldn't go across the Isle of Wight. But when she died and I was entirely alone in the world, I went to sea as a as you say, a therapy. And although I wouldn't like to say I'm not frightened of the sea, I lost a lot of the horror. And I've been in many ships since, but I've never been in anything that was touching the Titanic for beauty. And she was so beautiful to look at, too. She was lovely.
Did you actually have nightmares about this sort of, about the Titanic sinking?
I had nightmares from the time it sank until I was 23. Terrible nightmares. And I used to waken in a terrible state and go to my mother's bedroom, and I saw her there, and I immediately calmed down. I didn't even waken up. If she was there, that was all right. When she died, I realised that these nightmares would get even worse. I hadn't got her to go to. And so I evolved what today is called a therapy, decided the only thing I could possibly do would be go to sea. And I didn't come out of my cabin for 4 days and nights. I was too frightened. But by that time, the stewardess realised I wasn't seasick. Absolutely made me get up on deck. And from that time onwards, I have travelled by sea until the war came, but since the war, I fly. But it didn't cure me, but I've never had nightmares since. It cured the nightmares.
When you go to see Dr. Ballard, what's going to happen? Do you know?
Well, the Titanic Historical Society are having a convention in Delaware to not celebrate, I suppose, to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the disaster. And he is coming to that convention, and I am going.
And I gather, I mean, we've already seen in the National Geographic magazine that he's been putting together some of his photographs.
That's right.
And presumably he's going to try and put together what, an enormous mosaic and perhaps a book?
Possibly, yes. He told me in his letter that he hoped to see me at the convention and that he was working hard on some work for it. Mm. I don't quite know what. Mm.
Here you are now, a pensioner, shall we say, in terms of age.
a long time.
I mean, are you in some ways now, having got through this terrible experience, enjoying it? Because now you're becoming, as it were, in your 70s and your 80s, a celebrity. You are an historic figure, aren't you? And I mean,
I'm a page out of a history book, and there are days when the pages feel a bit tattered. The schools are doing all sorts of things about the Titanic projects, and I've been all over the place as recently as 2 days ago, talking at the schools, and I am astounded at the knowledge the children have of this disaster. And as you say, I've become almost a celebrity. Sometimes I quite enjoy it because I get asked to various nice dinners and things. Sometimes I get really bored. There was a period last year when I wasn't very well, and I was going out talking about it 4 nights a week for 5 weeks. And at the end of that time, if anybody mentioned Titanic to me, I just felt like saying, go away.
But nonetheless, what must be fascinating is the reaction of children, because I suspect, I've seen this happen, that young people, women gets older, sometimes young people tend to regard elderly people as well, either has-beens or what have you. Mm-hmm. But with something like this, of course, they do the very opposite, don't they?
They do. That's perfectly true. It's, the children are very, very knowledgeable about it, and very interested in it. And I always advise the schools when I go there, I say to them, try and get a copy of A Night to Remember and let the children see that, because it is the only film that's ever been made about the Titanic which is absolutely authentic. And Commander Boxall was alive when that was made, as you know, and helped us with it. But I don't think there's any doubt the children should see that film and not these other stupid things that people have made. Very often I get a letter to say, got a copy of the film and showed it to the children.
Did you ever think one day that the Titanic actually be discovered? I mean,
I didn't think so. No.
There are many people who are talking about raising the Titanic, something which is obviously going to be much more difficult now. She's broken into pieces, the insides have been torn out, she is a shell. What's your feeling about the basic principle of raising her?
I don't think she should be raised. I'm not the sort of person that goes and haunts people's graves. I look upon a grave is just a piece of earth in which there is a rotting body. That doesn't worry me very much. But in this case, 1,513 people died unnecessarily. They shouldn't have died. If there'd been enough lifeboats, they wouldn't have died. But all this vast tragedy and everything that happened about it makes me look upon it as a different sort of grave. And I entirely endorse what Dr. Ballard said. His actual words were, "It is quiet and peaceful, and a fitting place for the remains of this greatest of sea tragedies to rest. May it forever remain that way, and may God bless these found souls. And that's exactly how I feel about it.